Welcome to Running Scared. I'm Coach Christine, a level 2 RRCA and a Run Walk Run certified coach. My friend, if you enjoy a bit of true crime, some spooky tales, you enjoy running or walking, or at least willing to get laced up and get out there, then welcome. You have found your corner of the internet and we are going to be fast friends. Let's go ahead and get started right into today's workout with a strong walking warm-up. In 3, 2, and 1, we're going to walk it out for 3 minutes where I can give you a little bit of details of what you can expect for today's case. But first and foremost, let's make sure that you're staying nice and tall, whether you walk or run in today's workout. We want to have a strong posture. Those shoulders are down and back. Your core is lightly engaged and you're staying light on those feet. If you're outdoors, we're going to make sure we're very mindful of our surroundings. Maybe you take out an earbud or an AirPod so you can hear what's going on around you. You're wearing bright, visible clothing, and someone knows when to expect you back home or at least where you're at. If you're inside on the treadmill, let's go ahead and bring it up to a 1% incline. That's going to help to minimize the impact on our joints. My friends, this case is very special. It's been submitted and written by a fellow true crime enthusiast, Dr. J, a brilliant scholar and researcher. You're going to get to hear more about Dr. J with the bonus episode after this workout. So stick around for a little cold case cool down as we get to chat with her, learn more about this case, and kind of do a little bit of a deep dive. But for now, it's probably good for you to know that this case, being a true crime one after all, is going to have some gory details, a little bit of violence and murder. So please be warned and keep that into consideration. And I know that you've probably already checked with your physician before starting this or any new fitness regimen. And as you continue to roll through this warm-up, know that we're going to use the RPE scale, which we like to put a little bit of a true crime spin on it. The RPE scale is the rate of perceived effort that helps us to fashion the workout. And we go from a scale of 1 to 10. 1, you're out for an easy peasy stroll with your bestie talking about your new favorite podcast, aka Running Scared. 10 is you're in an all-out sprint. You are sprinting for your life. Well, we're going to kind of hang out in more of a conversation pace for today. We're going to do 8-minute blocks, about a 3 or a 4 on that RPE scale. And then we're going to have 2-minute blocks where I'm going to suggest that you push up the pace a little bit for 2 minutes, getting a little stronger, feeling a little better. If at any point, though, you need to pull it back into a walk or make this a little lighter, do what you need for today's workout. You can also find that RPE true crime scale in our episode notes. All right, my friends, without further ado, we're going to get started here in 10 seconds. So nice and tall. Let's roll in 3, 2, and 1. My friends, we're going to set the stage. This tale begins in a dark and stormy night. February 17th, 1970, it's 3:42 a.m. And then 26-year-old Dr. Jeffrey McDonald placed an emergency call from his home at Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Now, Dr. McDonald was an Army captain. He's Princeton-educated, Green Beret. He served as a surgeon. Dr. McDonald was a physician for the Green Beret unit at Fort Bragg. He took care of the health of the Special Forces soldiers. While he wasn't, in fact, a Special Force soldier himself, he was indeed Army trained. So on this cold and rainy night, Dr. McDonald told the emergency operator, "We've been stabbed and people are dying." The call ended shortly afterward, and the military police, or the MPs, responded to 544 Castle Drive. The scene at this one-story base housing horrified the police as they entered. The McDonalds lived in a housing area for officers and non-commissioned officers, and the residence that they were at was a 4-unit brick building There were 2 one-floor apartments on either end and 2 two-story apartments in the middle, while the Dr. McDonald and his family lived in a single-story end unit. The front door was locked, and the MPs were hesitant to break in. One, however, found that the back door to a utility room was open. So when he went inside, he found absolute carnage. In the master bedroom of the McDonald residence, Dr. McDonald was lying next to his wife on a blood-covered floor. He had puncture wounds on his chest. He was alive, but barely. His wife, unfortunately, was not so lucky. She was found with multiple stab wounds in her chest and neck and a fractured skull. On the headboard of their bed, written in capital letters in all blood, was the word pigs. This was in 1970, and the scene was eerily reminiscent of the Manson murders, in which similar writing appeared on the walls of Sharon Tate's home. At the scene, the police discovered Colette McDonald and Dr. McDonald were not the only ones that had been attacked. McDonald's had 2 young children, Kimberly and Kristen. Both children were dead at the scene. This triple homicide stunned the military police. The dead, Colette McDonald, pregnant with her 3rd child, Kimberly McDonald, age 5, and Kristen, just 2 years old. Dr. McDonald was rushed to the hospital, leaving the police on the scene to unravel some of the grisly details of this evening. Colette, who was 4 months pregnant with her 3rd child, was lying on the floor of her bedroom. She had been repeatedly clubbed, both her arms were broken, and she had been stabbed 37 times with a knife and an ice pick. Her husband's torn pajama top was draped upon her chest. Kimberly, 5 years of age, was found in her bed in another room, and she had been clubbed in the head and stabbed in the neck with a knife between 8 to 10 times. Because these wounds were kind of so close together, the coroner couldn't even really 100% determine, so 8 to 10 was the closest that he could guess. Her younger sister, Kristen, again, just 2, was also found in her bed. She had been stabbed with a knife 33 times and stabbed with the ice pick 15 times. Her hands were cut in what appeared to be defensive wounds, and a baby bottle rested near her mouth. This was the detail that would haunt the first responders, as it reminded them that she was just 2 years old. All right, my friends, we have a few more minutes here in this segment. This is a great time. I know it's kind of, well, it is very sad. Let's go ahead and shake it out a little bit. Keep rolling on through here, and then we will learn a bit more. Because at the hospital, Dr. McDonald's wounds were examined, and he had at least 3 bruises on his head. They found a bruise on his shoulder and upper left arm, and a bruise on his left arm that all of these could be considered defensive wounds, but overall, Dr. McDonald's wounds were much less severe than his family's injuries. In addition to these various cuts and bruises, he had what a staff surgeon referred to, and I'm going to quote here, clean, small, sharp incision that caused that one lung to partially collapse. He was treated for his injuries, including this stab wound to the chest, at a nearby hospital. His injuries also included a knife wound that went through Dr. McDonald's bicep, puncture wounds to his arms, 2 cuts to his hand, 4 or 5 ice pick wounds to his chest, 2 knife wounds to his abdomen, and several ice pick wounds to his abdomen. So he was admitted to the hospital for treatment, but released after 1 week. According to Dr. McDonald's version of the crime, we have 2 minutes here before we have that option to push up. But according to Dr. McDonald, a Manson-like party of 4 had killed his family and injured him. In his words, they were chanting repeatedly, acid is groovy, and kill the pigs. In an interview with CID, the Criminal Investigative Division, McDonald protested his innocence. He blamed these intruders. The Manson case was still fresh on the mind of many as it had occurred in California just 6 months prior to this heinous evening. Dr. McDonald told investigators that on the evening of February 16th, he had fallen asleep on the living room. He was later awakened by the sounds of someone screaming. He wasn't sure if it was Colette, his wife, or Kimberly, his oldest daughter. He wasn't sure. But as he rose, he was attacked by three armed male intruders. And the fourth intruder, who he described as a white female in a white floppy hat, stood nearby with a lighted candle while chanting, "That acid is groovy and kill the pigs." The three males attacked him with a club and ice pick, and Dr. McDonald claimed he saw what he believes were two white men and a black man while this woman was there with them in the living room. He said that the black man wore an army jacket with sergeant stripes on his shoulder, and the woman had long blonde hair underneath this floppy hat and was wearing brown boots. My friends, we're about to go up into that first 2 minute segment. We're gonna push out of conversation pace. We're gonna go a little bit faster, about a 5 or 6 on that effort scale. It's just 2 minutes, gives you an opportunity to get a little stronger. Let's do it in 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Let's go. Regardless, if you choose to go up in this pace, you're going to stay right there in that conversation, or you need to pull it back. It's important that you're still staying nice and tall, making sure that your chest is open, your chin is up. Let's discuss this case a little bit more and get some more information. Dr. McDonald goes on to say that he had pulled his pajama top over his head to help to ward off the thrust from the ice pick. So evidently it was magical fabric. But Dr. McDonald stated that he was overcome by his assailants and he was knocked unconscious in the living room at the end of the hallway leading to the bedrooms. When he came to, Dr. McDonald stated that the house was eerily silent and he could no longer hear the screams of his wife or older daughter. He went to his wife, and when he found her, he tried to revive her, but he found that she was already dead. So he went on and covered Colette with his torn pajama top. Remember the magic pajama top. And then he went to check on his daughters. Dr. McDonald told investigators of his attempts to resuscitate each child, but found that they too were beyond his help. He indicated that he stopped in the bathroom to check on his own wounds, washing his hands while he was there. And then Dr. McDonald called the operator asking for the military police and an ambulance. You're going to keep pushing, my friend. We will hear more about this case in just 20 seconds when we all meet back in that conversation, that 3 to 4. Staying strong all the way to the end. Here for 10, 5, 4, 3, and 1. Great work. 8 minutes here. Settle back into your groove. Give yourself a little bit. Your heart rate's going to come down. You'll find that your breath is a little easier. Well, the CID decided that they were going to kind of focus on learning more about Dr. McDonald, because while at that time it was unheard of for a beloved husband to hurt his family, folks that were in law enforcement were kind of trained to believe that they had to make sure that there was no stone left unturned. So I'm sure they too did not believe in that magic pajama top. But they focused on Dr. McDonald and learned that he was born on October 12th, 1943 in Jamaica, New York. In high school, he was voted both most popular and most likely to succeed. He won a scholarship to the Princeton University, and he was described as charming and charismatic. And while at Princeton, he resumed his high school romance with Colette Stevenson. had dated in high school and went on to become college sweethearts again. And in the fall of 1963, well, Dr. McDonald learned that Colette was expecting, so he went ahead and put a ring on it. Their first child, Kimberly, was born in April of 1964. And after McDonald graduated from Princeton, he and his family moved to Chicago, where he attended Northwestern University Medical School. A second child, Kristen, was born in May of 1967, just the following year after his graduation from medical school. Dr. McDonald completed an internship at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York, and then he decided to join the Army. So he packed up his entire family and they moved to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Dr. McDonald was appointed to the Green Berets as the group surgeon in 1969, and his wife Colette had just begun taking college classes after their arrival in Fayetteville. The CID studied the physical evidence and it did not seem to support the story told by Dr. McDonald because, well, it just didn't all add up. So they started to look at him as potentially a person of interest. For example, that living room where Dr. McDonald had supposedly fought for his life against the three armed assailants, well, it showed little signs of struggle apart from an overturned coffee table and a plant. But the plant was actually righted by a first responder, so the scene appeared even a little bit more staged. Fibers from Dr. McDonald's torn pajama top were not found at all in the living room where he claimed that he had been torn by attackers. Instead, those fibers from that pajama were found under the body of Colette and in Kimberly's and Kristen's bedrooms. One fiber was found under Kristen's fingernails. Forensics experts believe that Colette was stabbed through the pajama top. The murder weapons were found outside the back door, and one of the murder weapons, a knife, was actually found inside the house. All three of these weapons were determined that they had come from the McDonald house. The tips of surgical gloves were found beneath the headboard where Pigs was written in blood, and they were identical in composition to a supply that Dr. McDonald kept in the kitchen. 4 minutes into this block, 4 more minutes to go. Check in again, make sure you're still staying tall. The McDonald family all had different blood types, which is a statistical anomaly, but this helped the CID to track what had happened in this very bloody scene. And while forensics were in its infancy, each having a different blood type helped investigators track the events as they believed had really unfolded. So the investigators came up with a theory that the fight actually began in the master bedroom. Colette, they think, may have hit her husband in the forehead with a hairbrush. Some people say that maybe it's because of disagreement over her classes and that she was considering a career after her pregnancy. Others speculated that maybe there was some jealousy on Dr. McDonald's half because of a potential affair that they had come up with, maybe from her diaries. The CID sought to show that Dr. McDonald retaliated by beating her with a piece of stray lumber in the home. He was goaded into that fit of rage by her throwing the hairbrush. Kimberly, whose brain serum was found in the doorway, was struck possibly by accident during the fight. So it sounds like Kimberly may have been awoken from this fight that had broken out and gone to check on her parents. There's others that believe that potentially Kimberly was already in the bed with her mother. Regardless of whatever it may be, believing that Colette was dead, Dr. McDonald carried the mortally wounded Kimberly back to her bedroom, and he had no choice but to finish up the job and then blame attackers for the murders. So after he stabbed and bludgeoned her, they alleged that Dr. McDonald went to Kristen's room intent of disposing of the last remaining witness. But before he could kill her, Colette, whose blood was found on Kristen's bed covers and on one wall of the room, regained consciousness, stumbled in, and threw herself over her daughter to protect her. But after killing them both, Dr. McDonald wrapped his wife's body in his sheet and carried it back to the master bedroom, leaving a footprint of Colette's blood on the way out. Again, all of this was theorized because of the amount of evidence they were able to find in the blood type. The CID investigators also figured that Dr. McDonald had attempted to cover this up using articles of the Manson family murders that he had found in an issue of Esquire that was in his living room. He then took a scalpel from a supply in the hallway closet and went to the adjacent bathroom where he stabbed himself. By putting on surgical gloves from his supply, he went to the master bedroom and then he used Colette's blood to write pigs on the headboard, completing the staging. Finally, he laid his magical pajama top over Colette and repeatedly stabbed her in the chest with an ice pick. Dr. McDonald then used the phone to summon the ambulance, discarded the weapons, and lay by the body of his wife while he waited for the military police to arrive. At our next 2-minute segment in just 30 seconds, and we'll continue to learn more about this case. So staying nice and tall, knowing that we have the strength, we have the stamina, we can push into that 2 minutes just a little faster. In 5, 4, 3, two, and one. So, my friend, if you're thinking, he totally did it, well, that's what the Army thought as well, because on May 1st, 1970, the Army formally charged Dr. McDonald with the murder of his family. Dr. McDonald endured a long Article 32 hearing, and he also was represented by Bernard Siegel, a civilian defense attorney from Philadelphia. Now, Siegel was definitely a good attorney. He mounted an effective defense of Dr. McDonald, which concentrated on the poor quality of the CID investigation and the existence of other suspects, specifically Helena Stokely. Siegel presented evidence that the CID had not properly managed the crime scene and lost critical evidence, including skin found under Colette's fingernails. In addition, he claimed to have located the woman that Dr. McDonald had seen the night of the murders in his apartment. Her name, again, Helena Stokely. She was a well-known drug user in the area. Witnesses claimed that Stokely had admitted involvement in the crimes, and several remembered her wearing clothing similar to what Dr. McDonald had described. With his defense, Dr. McDonald was cleared of all charges and was given an honorable discharge from the Army. My friend, don't let up that pace just yet. You have 30 more seconds here. I know this is where you usually want to stop and be like, what? They did what? Neither here nor there. Keep going. 425. Learn more about this case and all of the potential little tidbits. In 10, we'll pull back into a nice even conversation pace. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Great work. We'll be here for 8 minutes, then we'll have a 2-minute on the other side opportunity to walk it out for our cool down before we head into our official cold case cool down chat. So now, free to live his life, Dr. McDonald returned to New York and began going on talk shows where he made light of the murders. He moved to California to continue his medical career, dated beautiful women. He even bought himself a yacht. Clearly, he was pretty set on living his best life, because it doesn't quite end there yet, though. Colette McDonald's stepfather was unconvinced of Dr. McDonald's innocence, so he hounded the Justice Department, which eventually convened a civilian grand jury, and they indicted Dr. McDonald on 3 counts of murder. Ironically, Freddie Kassab, Colette's stepfather, was initially a staunch McDonald supporter. At the Article 32 hearing, he had said, "If I ever had another daughter, I'd still want the same son-in-law." After Dr. McDonald was discharged from the Army, his behavior became even more suspicious, though. And Kasab said that, he wasn't really believing the story quite so much anymore. Dr. McDonald even called Kasab to claim that he and a group of friends had tracked down one of the killers and put him, in his words, 6 feet under. He was also disgusted by Dr. McDonald's public appearances on television, which made him suspicious, and as Dr. McDonald even made jokes about the case. The civilian trial lasted from July 16th to August 29th, 1979, and McDonald attempted to argue both double jeopardy, which was denied because the first trial was a military court, and then his right to a speedy trial had been violated. Both motions were eventually struck down. Prosecutors argued the physical evidence retrieved at the crime scene proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime scene had been arranged and that only Dr. McDonald could have rearranged it. The evidence included the threads from his pajamas found under and around the body of his wife in the bedroom, the absence of threads from his pajamas in the living room where he claimed to have been attacked by the intruders. It went on with blood samples from his daughter on his eyeglasses, which he claimed were knocked off in the struggle, blood stains from his wife on the pajama top, and other blood stains that indicated the sites of assaults inconsistent with his testimony. Other evidence recovered at the scene pointed to, well, we guessed it, Dr. McDonald and his guilt, that included splinters from the club used to hit one daughter and the wife, and Dr. McDonald's bloody footprint leaving his daughter's room, hairs, fabric, ice pick wounds to the wife's chest. Dr. McDonald was at this point convicted of one count of first degree murder in the death of Kristen and two counts of second degree murder in the deaths of Colette and Kimberly. He was immediately given 3 life sentences to be served consecutively. But my friend, this is still a bit of a cold case because despite his conviction, Dr. McDonald has always claimed his innocence. Dr. McDonald's supporters claim that the prosecution suppressed evidence in this case, and they did indeed. In the years since the trial, defense lawyers have used the Freedom of Information Act to find evidence that the government did not present at trial. We have 4 minutes here at this 3 to 4 on that effort scale before we pull it back into our 2-minute walk. Then we'll go into our cold case cool down, where you get to hear some of these possibilities discussed by Dr. J. Again, we had unidentified fingerprints and fibers that were found in the apartment. Well, those never really were matched to anyone known to have been in the house prior to the murders. However, fingerprint examplers of the children were not obtained, and Colette's fingerprint were of poor quality, as they were taken subsequent to her embalming. Other suppressed evidence that has been discovered was 2 unidentified 22 inches long synthetic hairs that were found, but not pointed out specifically to the defense. Dr. McDonald's lawyers claimed that these hairs were from the wig that was worn by Helena Stokely, but the government contended that more than likely they were from one of the children's dolls. Stokely did, in fact, own a long blonde wig that she was very fond of wearing. A military policeman did report seeing a blonde woman matching Stokely's description standing on a street corner not far from the murder scene when he was en route to respond to Dr. McDonald's emergency call for help. Stokely did, in fact, own a long blonde wig that she was fond of wearing. A military policeman did report seeing a blonde woman matching Stokely's description standing on a street corner not far from the murder scene where he was en route to respond to Dr. McDonald's emergency call. And Stokely repeatedly confessed to having been in the McDonald residence on the night of the murders. At trial, Stokely testified that she owned a blonde wig and a floppy hat and that she always wore black clothing. but claimed to have memory loss concerning her whereabouts between midnight and 6 a.m. on the night of the murders. Some more details is that according to Google Maps, it says that it takes about 11 minutes to walk from that corner where she was spotted to 544 Castle Drive. And first responders did report seeing her near the scene as they rushed to answer Dr. McDonald's call. However, the hairs differed from each other in composition and were found in a hairbrush, which points to the unlikely scenario that an intruder brushed her hair at the scene and was wearing more than one wig. This unlikely event supports the prosecutor's contention that there were doll's hairs brushed with Colette's hairbrush. At one point, Stokely claimed that Jeffrey McDonald's refusal to give medicine to drug addicts had spurred her and her friends to annihilate the McDonald family. And to the reason why Dr. McDonald had been spared, or at least not as heavily beaten or attacked, well, Stokely says that she has her reasons for that. We'll learn that in our 2-minute cool down, because we're about to wrap up this conversation, Pace. Just 20 seconds. We'll cool it down. Then we'll meet for our official cold case cool down chat. So bring it back down in 10, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Great work. Give yourself a pat on the back. Just going to ease into a walk here. Well, Stokely said the reason why they kind of spared Dr. McDonald was because, in her words, human sacrifice involving a pregnant woman is the most prestigious for the cult members. However, authorities think that Stokely may have been suffering from delirium, and she was unreliable due to her heavy narcotics use. But in one final blow to Dr. McDonald's case, Stokely did end up recanting her testimony. Stokely, though, died of liver cirrhosis at only 32 years old. Now, there is a few more markers of inconsistencies, including a spot of blood that was either type O or type B that was found in the hallway. McDonald's supporters continue to insist that this was not disclosed to the defense despite the existence of the trial transcripts. Supporters also point to black wool fibers found on Colette McDonald's mouth and shoulder as evidence of intruders that the government deliberately did not report because of their focus on Dr. McDonald himself. In 1995, two McDonald supporters, Jerry Allen Potter and Fred Bost, wrote Fatal Justice, a book meant to both refute Joe McGinnis's fatal vision and present the evidence they claimed had been hidden by government prosecutors. They asked for more testing of evidence with the advancement of laboratory science. However, DNA test results released March 10th, 2006, did not match Helena Stokely nor her boyfriend of the time, Greg Mitchell's DNA. All right, friend, we have finished up this case, or the time that we have right here, right now. Go ahead and join us for the official cold case cool down chat. And before we go to that, I want to remind you, I like to wrap up all of our running scared cases with a few little walkaway lessons learned. First lesson, pretty obvious. If by some chance you decide to slay your entire family in the middle of the night, maybe if you're so lucky to get found not guilty, don't go do the television circuit, the talk show circuit. Don't do that. And the most important lesson from this particular case is, instead of wanting to grow up and marry a doctor who might kill you in the middle of the night, go ahead and grow up and become a doctor like Dr. J. Thanks again, friends, for joining in on this Running Scared episode. Please rate, review, subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for Running Scared with Coach Christine.